Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. As a species, and I'm going to get pretty 30,000 foot here with this stuff today. As a species, we tend to normalize things. And that word, normalize, that's actually a technical term. But it's one of those that's also become vernacular, sort of become everyday language for we treat thing X as normal. Which isn't really all that different from the technical definition, which is the cognitive and social process of making abnormal, new, or challenging behaviors and situations appear routine, unremarkable, and acceptable. I'm going to read that again because there's quite a bit packed into there. The cognitive and social process, so both in our heads, if you will, in our understanding might be a better way to think about that, and socially, between ourselves, the cognitive and social process of making abnormal, and for the Latin nerds among us, the Latin prefix a means without, so without normality. The abnormal, new, or challenging behaviors and situations appear routine, unremarkable, and this last one's a very important part of the definition, and acceptable. For me, aside from what I just said about abnormal, one of the most interesting words in that definition is the word new. How long do we think of something as new? Or to put it another way, how long does it take for something that is abnormal, new, or challenging, the words from our definition, to become regarded as normal or assumed to be the norm? Now, obviously, that the answer to that is not a number. That's an experience, right? That would vary considerably. But let's just take an everyday example from our environment right here, okay? Let's take the example of electricity. Okay, so I could get excessively nerdy about this. I promise to exercise at least some restraint. There are lots of interesting milestones, but here's a couple of highlights. So the beginning, as far as we know it, from a Eurocentric history perspective, is 600 BCE in Greece. Some philosopher is rubbing a piece of amber with some silk, and he charges the amber, and he notices that it attracts small objects. So he stumbles across static electricity, 600 BCE. Now, little leap forward to 1752. See, Ben Franklin proves that lightning is electricity by flying a kite in a lightning storm with a key on it. So he simultaneously demonstrates that lightning is electricity, while also demonstrating that scientists have lower self-regard than other humans. Sometimes my humor is only funny to me. 1800, Alessandro Volta invents the first battery. We get the electric term volt from his name. 1820s and 30s, somebody links electricity and magnetism. Somebody else, Michael Faraday, invents the electric motor, also the Faraday cage, which for the guitar nerds among us know that that's a way of shielding a pickup so it doesn't make noise through your amplifier, so we're still using the Faraday cage. So this early 1820s, late 1800s, so this is sort of getting closer to home, Thomas Edison introduces incandescent light bulbs, the first one of which, when he kind of got it really working, would last for a couple of hours, and then when he really refined it, he got an electrode that would last for 40 hours. And I was researching this at the same time I was putting some new LED bulbs in the house, and I was looking on the box, and it's like 15,000 hours. So like we're making some progress in terms of longevity here. And then Nikola Tesla, George Westinghouse figure out how to use alternating current, and that allows for the transmission of electricity, right? So there's sort of the journey. So from, if you want, a 600 BCE and then a big gap, 1752 to late 1800s, that's the process. And then if we bring it local, electric streetlights first come to Winnipeg in 1880s. 1894, we get our first electric streetcar. Those are no longer with us except for the symbolic one in front of
you know, one of the concert venues here in the city. 1906, Pinawa Generating Station, first hydroelectric station on the Winnipeg River. 1911, Pointe du Bois plant is commissioned, establishing, and I thought this was quite interesting, low-cost electricity rates, which at that point, so this is 1911, electricity cost 3 1/3 cents per kilowatt hour. It currently costs 8.19 cents per kilowatt hour. So there's a number that really hasn't moved nearly as dramatically as some other energy sources in terms of cost to the consumer here in Manitoba. 1923, first all-electric home, which this would be, is toured in Winnipeg. Here's the point of all of that. When you came in here this morning, when we got up this morning, we just flipped the switch and the lights came on, right? And many of those bulbs in this setting are LED bulbs, which only 65 years or so ago would have been regarded as a material impossibility. The way an LED light works 65 years ago, if somebody would have tried to explain that, the person listening would have said they were talking about a miracle, if by miracle we mean something we don't understand. It was impossible, and now they're everywhere. In other words, what we regard as normal, when we use electricity as our illustration, has been part of our human experience in this part of the world, sort of our lived experience, for just over 100 years. It's new. Anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens, have existed for about 300,000 years. In other words, electricity, which we think of as normal, has been around for less than 0.03% of our history as a species. We've been without it for 99.97% of our history, but we've normalized it. In fact, right here in East St. Paul, we've had a couple of power outages recently that got people so bent out of shape that they collectively complained, a bunch of entitled, anyway, complained to Manitoba Hydro, and Manitoba Hydro responded. They're upgrading. Anyway, you know, we take it for granted. And when it's disrupted, we notice, right? I once heard a cultural commentator observe that we as a human collective are one power failure away from chaos. That's the other side of normalization. We might call it presumption. We might call it blasé consumption. We call it plain old just taking it for granted. I mention all of this by way of introducing something that many of us have normalized, but we probably shouldn't. It's Easter Sunday, day when Christianity as a religion marks the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Many of us may have normalized that, both as a day on the calendar and as an historic event. That's how we were taught about it. At some point in our lives, though, it was a new story. We heard it somewhere for the first time. And perhaps if that first time occurred when we were a child, we might have had some questions about it as we grew, as we developed a capacity for critical thinking and questioning. And if we had questions about this event that was called the resurrection, when we asked those questions, we might have received answers along a continuum ranging from this isn't something you question, or if we don't have this, we don't have anything, to you're right. It's a crazy old story, and many points in between. But I think the odds are pretty good that at least if we were in a Christian settings, nobody chose to challenge our normalization of it. Remember our definition of normalization? The cognitive and social process of making abnormal, new, or challenging behaviors and situations appear routine, unremarkable, and acceptable. One downside of that whole process for us is that we start to assume that behaviors or situations are normal. Another is that we start to live as though we can't live without them or reconsider them. And when it comes to exploring what you believe, that's too tight a corner. that's not a healthy place to live. So what I want to do today is challenge the normalization of the Christian resurrection story. As always, I'm not offering this so you can agree with me, but rather as a prompt for exploring what we believe, in this case, what we believe about resurrection stories in general, and perhaps what we believe about this particular story in the context of Christianity. Think of this as a journey with several stops along the way. You could make the whole trip, or you can kind of get off wherever you choose, but the track, as I'm going to lay it out, is linear, not circular. I'm not exploring this just so we can end up where we started, but as a catalyst for continued exploration. So again, not an unusual paradigm in our setting. So, stop number one. Christianity is not the only ancient faith to worship a deity who dies and then rises again. In fact, not even close. The Bible was written, and particularly the First Testament collections, were written in the ancient Near East. And in that region of the world, at that time in history, there were lots of stories of divine death and resurrection, all or almost all of which were closely tied to the agricultural cycle. More about that shortly. But the landmark study on this comes from a scholar named James Fraser, 1922 classic study of world religion and mythology, a study called The Golden Bough. In that study, Fraser makes the argument that early Christians likely chose a spring date for Easter to coincide with existing pagan festivals, for those other festivals resurrected gods. So there's already a bunch of, the culture is surrounded by a bunch of stories about deities dying and coming back from the dead. Christianity is making its story, and as culture makers, they do what we do. They work with the stuff they have, right, to make this story. Cale and I were talking about this yesterday a little bit when they were over for Easter. And Cale said, basically, like, it's not out of line to think about all of this stuff as fan fiction, right? These are stories written by the people who were making the stories as they went in response to stories that were already there, which is fan fiction, right? We could treat that as a dismissive idea, as a denigrating idea, which is how we might tend to regard fan fiction versus the work of an original author. But in this case, it's just a collection. It's like making fan fiction out of fan fiction out of fan fiction, out of lived experience. How do we explain what's happening here when things die and come back to life? How do we deal with that as humans? What does that mean? How can that even happen? I don't know about you guys, but I have this lived experience every spring. Maybe it's just me, but a week ago, everything was like frozen, rock solid. We were out with the dogs yesterday, and Kareen said, "Hey, look. Green grass, some grass starting to poke up in the places that we, you know, had snow-blowed tracks for them to run around in the yard." How does that even happen? Okay, so now just zoom out, because dealing with normalization requires zooming out. So now just zoom out a little bit and consider that there's nothing new about this human experience and the need to explain it. How in the world could the world come back to life the way that it does every spring? That's unbelievable. No, it happens. We have to find a way to believe it. We have to find a way to explain it. It's what we do. I observed in a recent conversation that the date for Easter is determined by the cycles of the moon, and somebody in the space expressed surprise, noting that seemed like a fairly pagan way to choose the date for a Christian religious event. Once again, normalization and its attendant assumptions show up. It's a Christian religious event. Here's the normalized version. It's a Christian religious event, therefore it always has been, and it must depend on some uniquely Christian framework or perhaps literal history to mark when it happened. And that does not need to be the case. It occurs, Easter in this case, occurs on the first Sunday after the first full moon, occurring on or after the vernal equinox, which is one of two points in the Earth's orbit where the sun crosses the celestial equator, leading to nearly equal hours of daylight and darkness. That's a non-religious celestial event that has been observed and made meaning of since the first humans thoughtfully noted the connection between the cycles of the moon and the seasons. That's old, not new. And we could make similar observations about the date for Christmas, which has, you know, absolutely no relationship to any literal baby's birth, including a baby named Jesus, about whose actual birth date we know nothing definitive. Beyond those fairly close ties between the Christian story and the cycles of the moon, the Christian resurrection story itself was born in a cultural context that included several other high-profile resurrection narratives. I'm not going to, again, I could really get into these, but what I'm going to do instead is just kind of give us a greatest hits here a little bit. So probably the best known of those stories in that context is the story of Tammuz. Tammuz is the spring god of Mesopotamia. And by the way, there's lots of discernible overlap between what Jesus taught and what the surrounding ancient cultures historically believed, including the Mesopotamian culture, which had considerable influence in the beliefs of the Hebrew people, because from the Mesopotamians come the Babylonians. The Babylonians took the Hebrews captive. They absorbed the culture in which they lived and functioned, right? So again, no surprise. Like this is the way the wider story of human history goes. So Tammuz, the spring god of Mesopotamia, and what happened here is that again, this story is tied to spring, which totally makes sense once you hear the story. So to take that Tammuz story as an example, and it's the only one that I'll explore in any detail, in that story, Ishtar is the great mother goddess of Mesopotamia and the source of nature's fertility and abundance. So if you're going to do an exercise like this, it's worth kind of taking a moment to go, how do we account for this now? Like, what's the story we tell ourselves now to explain this same human experience, all right? Because that's what they were doing. They were explaining their experience. Her lover is Tammuz, this handsome young god. Crazy thing about Tammuz is he died each winter and had to go to the underworld, because that's where you go when you die in Mesopotamian culture and beliefs. What happens during that same time is Ishtar travels to the realm of the dead to rescue her lover. She follows her lover. Remember, she's the source of life. She's the source of fertility and green things and living things. And she goes after her lover for 6 months of the year. She goes on a rescue mission. And so during that time, the world is robbed of all of its fertility. It's robbed of its reproduction. It's robbed of its growth. And then every spring, the stern goddess of the underworld, Allatu, would allow this imprisoned couple to be sprinkled with the water of life. Pay attention, because I just described the roots of baptism, okay? Sprinkled with the water of life and return to the world of the living, and they bring life and green vegetation back to earth. So in the Babylonian calendar, the resurrection was celebrated during the month of Tammuz, which fell in late June and early July. All across the ancient Near East, later cultures put their own twist on the spring resurrection story. The Phrygians have the tale of Attis, who was brought back to life in the spring equinox by Cybele, the fertility goddess. The Greeks have the myth of Persephone, kidnapped by Hades, allowed to return every spring from the underworld. And that heralds the return of vegetation and grain production, and so on. And that's without exploring any of the stories that come from Egypt or India or China or from the Norse legends. There's just oodles of them. And by the way, all of those cultures also normalized their resurrection stories. And that's without, as Tim mentioned last week, and Sarah, you popped up a post about this, there's all the fictional characters who die and come back to life, so as distinct from mythological characters, including relatively contemporary figures like in your post Captain America story, Gandalf sort of famously, Harry Potter, right? Resurrection stories in all of those. So those are narratives about this. So it seems to me that as humans, we really do love a good resurrection story. And there's something going on in there that we don't just love, but that I would say we need. So I want to suggest what some of those themes might be, those deeply resonant human themes that arc over particular religious expressions of them. They show up there, but they encompass them, if you will. And then I want to invite us to think a little bit about what some of our own stories might be that live in that same or in adjacent spaces. So first of all, one of the reasons we love these stories is because resurrection stories offer hope. And they offer comfort. And who doesn't need some of that at any time, but perhaps especially when things seem to be like hope and comfort seem to be in short supply? Resurrection stories tap into that vein in a few different ways. First of all, they tend to make the assumption that death is humanity's greatest enemy and that resurrection totally defeats it. It's its other side. And you have to push into this idea pretty vigorously before you start to see or hear from thinkers who might point out that while it might be fair to call death a problem, not ever being able to die can also be a problem. It's not that hard to find stories about just coming back and coming back and coming back until somebody's like, please, just let me die. Different lines on that. But that's a big working assumption. This is the big problem. Resurrection is the big solution. Second thing is these stories reassure people that any suffering, loss, or pain that we're presently suffering is temporary, right? There's more to this than that. Pretty powerful stuff. And the third way that they resonate with us is they offer reassurance in hard times by providing hope that joy can return. Acting is what one person I read called the cemetery evangelist that changes hope to despair. It's like on the edge of there's no more, there's more, right? We don't have to see this as the end. It's the this too shall pass notion that can get us through a lot. And in addition to offering hope and comfort, these sorts of stories can carry deep symbolic and deep psychological resonance. For example, resurrection stories offer sort of the ultimate reset button, right? Like, think about it. If resurrection is a real thing, then it's implied that mistakes can be forgiven, relationships restored, life can begin again, even after absolute failure. And that sort of story shape can also help us to make sense out of chaos. In these stories, life frequently emerges from chaos and death. This is where we get a phoenix story, right? From the ashes. And that can give us a way to make sense of existence. I've frequently observed that meaning-making is a central human task. So what we find in resurrection stories is a way to cope with what we might otherwise have to acknowledge as the randomness of life, which is a hard pill to swallow. the notion that things might happen that we can't explain, that's hard on us as human beings, because acknowledging it amounts to admitting that hard things can happen to anyone and that there might not be a tidy way forward when it does. We do not like that idea at all. One of the implications of this is also that resurrection stories point to the possibility of a kind of, as I touched on a moment ago, kind of a rising from the ashes dynamic, in which even the dead get not just a better ending, but also a beautiful new beginning. Different side of the same coin, if you will. That's the Christian notion that's running in the background of baptism, by the way, of course, right? Symbol of dying to a previous way of life, rising to a new way of life, a new beginning. That's also the story shape of religious ideas about the dead rising to a new life in general, the central idea there being that the grave is not the end. Anyone who has ever had to grieve the lost presence of someone beloved can probably fairly easily tap into how appealing this is. This isn't goodbye. It's only until we meet again can be an incredibly comforting idea. One of my siblings wrote a beautiful song about that idea on the death of one of my grandparents, a song called See You on the Other Side. That's that idea, right? Okay, one last idea. For some of us, the idea that all these structures are mythology rather than literal history is a tough one to consider. In very general terms, most of us find it easy to dismiss the resurrection stories of other traditions as, you know, interesting but not historically true, but might find it rather difficult to do that with the stories we grew up being told were facts, even if they were presented as facts shrouded in mystery. And even if that declaration doesn't hold up very well under certain kinds of examination. Two things here. First of all, what do you think the kids who grew up around those other stories were told? Do you think they were told, hey, this is just a cute fairy tale. Don't worry about it. Not consequential. Easily dismissed. Not likely. Circle back for a moment to what we considered regarding normalization. These stories can sometimes help us navigate the most difficult parts of life. So, of course, we normalize them. It's a huge part of how we cope. And there's no shame in coping, folks. I mean, we can all find better and worse ways to cope, to be sure. But coping is what we do. And if we find a powerful story that helps us cope, that we would cling to that story is just so not a surprise. Being willing to reconsider those stories and even how they might help us best, that can be more than a little bit disruptive. It can also be quite liberating if what we're experiencing is dissonance around a story that was working and isn't working the way that it used to. So, in the interest of sort of finding a gentler point of entry than all of those disruptive things I was just gesturing toward, let me offer this. Just wanted to take a moment. Think about your own story. Zoom out. Think about your own story or those you know from people around you. And now I want you to think, that's very unfocused. Let me bring it into focus a little more. Think about chapters in those stories that are about starting over, new beginnings, taking your life back, those kinds of ideas, right? One of the reasons we sometimes back away from our own resurrection stories is because of what you just described. It's terrifying. You didn't say that about your story.
Well, but
right?
It is.
Yeah, right? But like, it's just like, what? I don't know this. And the unknown for us is a little domino effect that's pretty easy when you say it in a sentence and pretty horrible when you experience it, right? But uncertainty, the unknown creates uncertainty. Uncertainty creates fear. And fear is like one of the most powerful, fast moving emotions that we know, right? Like it's a big motor. And it's just like click, click, click. And so we don't like uncertainty. That's why we make stories, right? But even when we desire that next, I want to be healthy and I want to live a healthy life. I want to be my own person and not somebody whose personhood is always subservient to somebody else in the story that you told, right? Even when we're at those intersections, it's still just like, can I even do this? Because it's such a huge maneuver. Yeah. We could go on. I'm going to, for those that are precise about time, you might already feel like I'm not respecting your time, but I'm going to come closer to it than I would if I kept going. The sorts of things that you've shared and the sorts of things that might be going on in your recollection and in your thoughts and your feelings right now that you're not sharing, those I would submit to you are resurrection stories with all their attendant joys and challenges. And they can serve the same purpose as the more famous stories do, without laboring under the need to be turned into religious dogma. And the religious stories, the already existing stories, can inform our imaginations about other ways that we might begin anew or even just hang in there when the going is tough. We don't have to swallow their context whole to have them be of benefit. We might choose to do that, but it's a choice. And one of the things I hope that this little exploration has offered us is a way to think about whatever resurrection stories we're aware of, whatever resurrection stories we've been exposed to, or story, if it's one that predominates. Those stories have, they've got big muscles. They've got a lot of power resident in them. And also, we are surrounded by resurrection stories that we have access to because they're a lived experience. And they also have big muscles. They also have lots of power. And I don't think we need to be reluctant about accessing that power to help us continue to explore what we believe. Peace.